Hi, Dave Emery here. This is side one of For the Record program number 805, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on August 10th of the year 2014. As is so often the case, many of the topics that we will be covering and or updating today will be referential to other material on the SpitfireList.com website. That website has my entire life's work, some 35 years or so on the air, available for download for free, with copious amounts of written information and a small library of old, out-of-print anti-fascist books, again, available for download for free. So please use the SpitfireList.com website. We are going to cover a couple of topics, albeit imperfectly, and again, I emphatically encourage listeners to go to other material dealing with some of the topics that I will briefly touch on. We're going to be covering a couple of topics that we really have not talked much about. There is an awful lot going on in the world. I'm reminded of the old mid-60s top 40 hit by Barry McGuire called The Eve of Destruction. And one of the lines goes, "The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading." And that is something of an update. And I would note that bullets are loading elsewhere as well, including right here in the U.S. We are going to be talking about what is going on in Iraq with ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria or in Syria and Iraq. And we're also going to talk about the standoff at the ranch of Cleven Bundy, B-U-N-D-Y, in Montana. Both of those are important topics, and we're going to go into them at some length. But again, the coverage that I will be presenting here is incomplete, and I will touch briefly on other things that should be reviewed and gone into in detail by the listeners that are available on the SpitfireList.com website. We have been presented with almost daily news of the military onslaught by ISIS, again, the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Those are Sunni jihadists that have been blitzkrieging across much of Iraq after having already taken over parts of Syria. We are being told that, well, this is a threat, and the right wing has been faulting Barack Obama in light of the people that, first of all, launched the Iraq invasion, and that also mishandled the occupation massively. I think that is more than a little arrogant. It should be noted that not only has Mr. Maliki mishandled governance of Iraq, he has had a Shia, anti-Sunni, anti-just about everybody else government. It has been anything but inclusive. And in addition to that, the Iraqis, to nobody's surprise, did not want a lingering U.S. military presence in the country. Obama's critics on the GOP right have a way of overlooking the fact that the Iraqis did not want, they vetoed a closer security arrangement. However, something that is even more removed from the spotlight and rhetorical discussion is the role of Prince Bandar. Up until this spring, the chief of Saudi intelligence and also a man who is so close to the Bush family that he is nicknamed Bandar Bush. Bandar, Prince Bandar, was a major player in U.S.-connected covert operations, including support for the Contras. He has been on trial in connection with a massive slush fund that was connected to arms purchases by Saudi Arabia. His counsel is former director of the FBI, Louis Free. So this is a very well-connected individual indeed. And again, his nickname is Bandar Bush. And we're not hearing about his probable role, probable central role in the events in Iraq. The following is from the Independent from the United Kingdom of July 13th of 2014. It's by Patrick Coburn, C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N, titled, Iraq Crisis, How Saudi Arabia Helped ISIS Take Over the North of the Country, and it reads as follows. The subhead, a speech by an ex-MI6 boss hints at the plan going back over a decade. By the way, MI6, British Foreign Intelligence. How far is Saudi Arabia complicit in the ISIS takeover of much of northern Iraq, and is it stoking an escalating Sunni-Shia conflict across the Islamic world? Sometime before 9/11, Prince Bandar bin Sultan, once the powerful Saudi ambassador in Washington and head of Saudi intelligence until a few months ago, had a revealing and ominous conversation with the head of the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, last name D-E-A-R-L-O-V-E. Continuing, Prince Bandar told him, quote, the time is not far off in the Middle East, Richard, when it will be literally God help the Shia, unquote. More than a billion Sunnis have simply had enough of them, unquote. The fateful moment predicted by Prince Bandar may now have come for many Shia, with Saudi Arabia playing an important role in bringing it about by supporting the anti-Shia jihad in Iraq and Syria. Since the capture of Mosul by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant or ISIS on June 10th, Shia women and children have been killed in villages south of Kirkuk, and Shia Air Force cadets machine-gunned and buried in mass graves near Tikrit. In Mosul, Shia shrines and mosques have been blown up, and in the nearby Shia Turkoman city of Tal Afar, T-A-L-A-F-A-R, 4,000 houses have been taken over by ISIS fighters as spoils of war, unquote. Simply to be identified as Shia or a related sect such as the Alawites and Sunni rebel-held parts of Iraq and Syria today has become as dangerous as being a Jew was in Nazi-controlled parts of Europe in 1940. There is no doubt about the accuracy of the quote by Prince Bandar, Secretary General of the Saudi National Security Council from 2005 and head of General Intelligence between 2012 and 2014, the crucial 2 years when al-Qaeda-type jihadis took over the Sunni armed opposition in Iraq and Syria. Speaking at the Royal United Services Institute last week, Dearlove, who headed MI6 from 1999 to 2004, emphasized the significance of Prince Bandar's words, saying that they constituted, quote, a chilling comment that I remember very well, indeed, unquote. Dearlove does not doubt that substantial and sustained funding from private donors in both Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to which the authorities may have turned a blind eye, has played a central role in the ISIS surge into Sunni areas of Iraq. He said, quote, such things simply do not happen spontaneously, unquote. This sounds realistic, since the tribal and communal leadership in Sunni-majority provinces is much beholden to Saudi and Gulf paymasters and would be unlikely to cooperate with ISIS without their consent. Dearlove's explosive revelation about the prediction of a day of reckoning for the Shia by Prince Bandar and the former head of MI6's view that Saudi Arabia is involved in the ISIS led Sunni rebellion has attracted surprisingly little attention. Coverage of Dearlove's speech focused instead on his main theme that the threat from ISIS to the West is being exaggerated because, unlike bin Laden's al-Qaeda, it is absorbed in the new conflict that is, quote, essentially Muslim on Muslim, unquote. Unfortunately, Christians in areas captured by ISIS are finding that this is not true, as their churches are desecrated and they are forced to flee. A difference between al-Qaeda and ISIS is that the latter is much better organized. If it does attack Western targets, the results are likely to be devastating. The forecast by Prince Bandar, who was at the heart of Saudi security policy for more than three decades, that the 100 million Shia in the Middle East face disaster at the hands of the Sunni majority, will convince many Shia that they are the victims of a Saudi-led campaign to crush them. Quote, "The Shia in general are getting very frightened after what happened in northern Iraq," unquote, said an Iraqi commentator who did not want his name published. Shia see the threat as not only military, but stemming from the expanded influence over mainstream Sunni Islam or Wahhabism, the puritanical and intolerant version of Islam espoused by Saudi Arabia that condemns Shia and other Islamic sects as non-Muslim apostates and polytheists. Dearlove says that he has no inside knowledge obtained since he retired as head of MI6 10 years ago to become master of Pembroke College in Cambridge. But, drawing on past experience, he sees Saudi strategic thinking as being shaped by two deep-seated beliefs or attitudes. First, they are convinced that there, quote, can be no legitimate or admissible challenge to the Islamic purity of their Wahhabi credentials as guardians of Islam's holiest shrines, unquote. But perhaps more significantly, given the deepening Sunni-Shia confrontation, the Saudi belief that they possess a monopoly of Islamic truth leads them to be, quote, deeply attracted towards any militancy which can effectively challenge Shia-dom, unquote. Western governments traditionally play down the connection between Saudi Arabia and its Wahhabist faith on the one hand and jihadism, whether of the variety espoused by Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda or by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's ISIS. There is nothing conspiratorial or secret about these links. 15 out of 19 of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, as was bin Laden and most of the private donors who funded the operation. The difference between al-Qaeda and ISIS can be overstated. When bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces in 2011, al-Baghdadi released a statement eulogizing him, and ISIS pledged to launch 100 attacks in revenge for his death. But there has always been a second theme to Saudi policy towards al-Qaeda-type jihadis, contradicting Prince Bandar's approach and seeing jihadis as a mortal threat to the kingdom. Dearlove illustrates this attitude by relating how, soon after 9/11, he visited the Saudi capital Riyadh with then-Prime Minister Tony Blair. He remembers the then-head of Saudi General Intelligence, quote, literally shouting at me across his office, quote, 9/11 is a mere pinprick on the West. In the medium term, it is nothing more than a series of personal tragedies. What these terrorists want is to destroy the House of Saud and remake the Middle East, unquote. In the event, Saudi Arabia adopted both policies, encouraging the jihadis as a useful tool of Saudi anti-Shia influence abroad, but suppressing them at home as a threat to the status quo. It is this dual policy that has fallen apart over the last year. Saudi sympathy for anti-Shia militancy, unquote, is identified in leaked U.S. official documents. The then U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wrote in December of 2009 in a cable released by WikiLeaks that, quote, Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for al-Qaeda, the Taliban, Lashkar-e-Taiba in Pakistan, and other terrorist groups, unquote. She said that, insofar as Saudi Arabia did act against al-Qaeda, it was as a domestic threat and not because of its activities abroad. This policy may now be changing with the dismissal of Prince Bandar as head of intelligence this year. But the change is very recent, still ambivalent, and may come far too late. It was only last week that the Saudi prince said he would no longer fund a satellite television station notorious for its anti-Shia bias based in Egypt. That prince is not identified here. I have a hunch that's Prince Al-Waleed, the second largest stockholder in News Corp, the parent company of Fox. The problem for the Saudis is that their attempts since Bandar lost his job to create an anti-Maliki and anti-Assad Sunni constituency, which is simultaneously against al-Qaeda and its clones, have failed. By seeking to weaken Maliki and Assad in the interest of a more moderate Sunni faction, Saudi Arabia and its allies are in practice playing into the hands of ISIS, which is swiftly gaining full control of the Sunni opposition in Syria and Iraq. In Mosul, as happened previously in its Syrian capital, Raqqa, potential critics and opponents are disarmed, forced to swear allegiance to the new caliphate, and killed if they resist. Not mentioned in this article are a number of things. First of all, the profound Republican Party links and the element of allied intelligence links to the Muslim Brotherhood. There is no mention of the Brotherhood in this article, as we have looked at in many programs, including recently for the record 773 and 790, the corporatist economics of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist group allied with the Axis during World War II, and then nurtured by elements of Western intelligence as anti-communist cadre during the Cold War. Their corporatist economics makes them very appealing to corporate interests in the West. The last couple of items in For the Record 790 about the disappearance, unquote, of Malaysian Air Flight 370 has some good information about that ideological pivot or tenet, and I refer listeners to that. Mention of 9/11 here makes no reference whatsoever to Operation Green Quest, and again, the profound Republican and Bush administration links to the funding apparatus for Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. When, on March 20th of 2002, the individuals and institutions involved with that operation were raided by elements of FBI and Treasury Department, a fellow who was a close political ally of both Georges Bush and a friend of both Georges Bush, as well as a director of Harkin Energy and the marketing director of Grover Norquist and Karl Rove's Islamic Free Market Institute, a guy named Talat Atman, interceded with then-Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the individuals and institutions that were raided there. And we have also looked at information in many programs, again, For the Record 773 and For the Record number 550, about apparent Western intelligence support for jihadist elements to be used against Russia in Chechnya and the Caucasus and against China in Xinjiang province. Again, go to the archives for on spitfirelist.com for information about that. I would also note that it was just this past spring that Prince Bandar resigned as head of Saudi intelligence. I wonder if perhaps that was because finally his role helping to stoke the insurgency in Syria and in Iraq had finally gotten to be a bit too much. This is from the Washington Institute from April 15th of 2014, article by Simon Henderson, H-E-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. Bandar resigns as head of Saudi intelligence. It reads in part, "The sudden shakeup at the top of the kingdom's intelligence service will likely have implications for Saudi policy on Iran and Syria. Earlier today, Saudi Arabia announced that controversial Prince Bandar bin Sultan had resigned as intelligence chief. According to the official Saudi press agency story, the unexpected royal decree stated that Bandar had been, quote, relieved from his post at his request, unquote, and replaced by General Youssef bin Ali al-Idrisi, his deputy at the General Intelligence Presidency, GIP, the Saudi equivalent of the CIA. No mention was made of Bandar's other official position as Secretary General of the Saudi National Security Council. The news comes less than 3 weeks after Bandar was reported to be returning from Morocco, where he had been convalescing for several weeks following shoulder surgery. Significantly, the spin on his absence was that he had still been running Saudi intelligence from his hospital bed, despite reportedly bequeathing at least the Syria portfolio to his cousin, Interior Minister Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, N-A-Y-E-F, in January. And last October, Bandar ruffled Washington's policymakers by briefing foreign journalists on Saudi exasperation regarding the Obama administration's Middle East policies. So again, I wonder about the resignation. There has been speculation that it was because of poor health. I have a feeling it had far more to do with the fact that his support for the Sunni jihadists that are now overrunning Iraq, in spite of the best efforts in that misguided war by our men and women in uniform, I suspect that has much to do with it. This article concludes, by the way, if Bandar retains his National Security Council role, that's Saudi Arabia, he will continue to wield influence in Riyadh. But given his antipathy toward Washington in recent months, the change may suggest an opportunity to further close the rift between the U.S. and the kingdom following last month's meeting between President Obama and King Abdullah outside Riyadh. So again, no one wonders if perhaps the information presented in the Independent article had to do with the fact of Prince Bandar's resignation a few months before. Another story that has, well, not received the coverage due it, and that we have all but it will not ignore. We simply haven't had much time for, and that concerns the iconic standoff at the Montana ranch of Cleveland Bundy. Cleveland Bundy had been, in fact, the whole Bundy family had been grazing their cattle on public lands without paying the very modest fee that is required. And then when federal agents went to his property to try to get him to pay up, a group of well-armed and tactically very sophisticated right-wing militia showed up and basically used force of arms, although they didn't have to fire, to back off elements of the federal government. This is very significant and falls right in line with what we have been talking about in connection with the neo-Confederate movement, the neo-secessionist movement, efforts to break up the U.S., and also the Turner Diaries, the neo-Nazi tract published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, in which paramilitary neo-Nazis rise up and basically take over the U.S. There is a very good article in Salon.com about a report from the Southern Poverty Law Center about the seriousness of the Cleveland Bundy situation and its implications. I would note quickly and in passing, although SPLC does some very good work, it is also very limited, and they do not really talk about the history of fascism, the support for fascism by powerful industrial and financial elites, the importation of the Galen-Odessa Nazis at the end of World War II, the overlapping crusade for freedom domestic covert operation, which took many of those Nazis and SS men and installed them as elements of the GOP. And there is no discussion whatsoever about the involvement of elements of the paramilitary right in covert operations and of their connection to this country's domestic political assassinations in AFA program number 12 and in a lecture that are available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. I talk about the militias and the militia movement and the links of a fellow who is mentioned here, a guy named William Popper Gale, to the paramilitary milieu that was run out of Guy Bannister's detective agency in New Orleans. That was a front for some of the elements that helped to kill President Kennedy, and they have also been involved in covert operations against Cuba. That lecture, by the way, is called The Militia Movement, Enemy or Pawn of the State, and it is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. Now, this article from Salon.com, it's a long one, and we're going to continue with it in side two. It's called A Much Larger and More Dangerous Movement, unquote. Right-wing militias thrive post-Bundy, and the media won't talk about it. It's by Paul Rosenberg from Salon.com from July 22nd of 2014. Subtitled, Cleveland Bundy Wasn't a One-Off. New report shows far-right militias are growing and more fear of homegrown terror. 3 months after the standoff at the Cleveland Bundy Ranch, the Southern Poverty Law Center has issued a report, quote, "War in the West, the Bundy Ranch Standoff and the American Radical Right," stating what should have been obvious at the time, but which most media coverage utterly obscured. The standoff was not some quirky, standalone event that spontaneously just happened out of the blue. Rather, it was a highly coordinated event reflecting the threat of a larger militia movement, which in turn has drawn together multiple threads of far-right ideology over the course of the last 40 years. I would mention before we continue, it is the milieu talked about here that is right at the center of what I call the Snowdenistas, the political milieu of Edward Snowden, who is, again, one of these anti-government extreme right-wingers in spite of his supporters' representations to the contrary. So when you're listening to this, remember that this is the milieu of Eddie the Friendly Spook and what I call the Palestinian Libertarian Organization. And I would note that many of the violent paramilitary right-wingers mentioned here, just like Edward Snowden, are enthusiastic supporters of Ron Paul and his son Rand Paul. By the way, Rand Paul now being touted by Ralph Nader. Continuing with this Salon.com article. On the purely tactical level, the report notes that Bundy's armed supporters had, quote, "overwhelming tactical superiority," unquote, due to their pre-positioning on the high ground above the confrontation under the direction of a Montana militia member and Iraq War veteran, which is a primary reason why the Bureau of Land Management wisely withdrew. On a somewhat broader level, the report warns of the events ripple effect. Quote, "Just in the months since the Bundy, quote, victory, unquote, tense standoffs between the BLM, that's the Bureau of Land Management, and anti-government activists have taken place across the West in Idaho, New Mexico, Texas, and Utah. That is in addition to the violent Las Vegas rampage of Bundy and Ron Paul supporters Jared and Amanda Miller, which left three innocents dead along with the two shooters. And it places these events in a larger context. First, in the Obama era, quote, since 2009, there have been 17 shooting incidents between anti-government extremists and law enforcement, unquote, but also beyond. It stretches as far back as the Whiskey Rebellion of the 1790s, but gaining much more organized coherence with the confluence of the racist anti-Semitic Posse Comitatus starting in the 1970s and two more mainstream movements, the Sagebrush Rebellion of the 1970s and 1980s, and the Wise Use Movement of the late 1980s and early 1990s. By the way, we went into the evolution of the American right wing and American fascism, including the Posse Comitatus, in AFA programs 10, 11, 12, and 13. Long programs, again, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. We will continue with this discussion in Side 2 because we're all out of time. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 805. Miscellaneous articles and updates being recorded on August 10th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.